Hey, good afternoon. So today we're going to talk a bit more about instruction sets, and in particular we're going to talk about the instruction set we'll be using for the part of the semester where we have you basically build a processor, which is going to be simpler than any of the instruction sets on this list. And it turns out that you've probably seen x86 as an instruction set and some toy instruction set in 2150, and maybe you've heard about ARM, but there are a lot of instruction sets out there still being made, not even obsolete. So for some reason, some people decided that, you know, they're not happy just using ARM or using x86. There's lots of choices being made. We'll look at some of those and how instruction sets vary, and then talk about the particular choices our textbook authors made in creating Y86, which is the instruction set we'll be using, which is based on x86, as you can guess from the name. Before I start, some anonymous feedback. A bunch of comments about the Why was the quiz on sections 4.1 to 4.3 when the readings for today were 4.1 and similar? So I guess this was not made clear enough. Generally, the pre-week quiz is for the entire week's lectures. So if you want to know what you're supposed to know, read for that, it's the entire week's material. The post-week quiz is on the entire week's lectures. We don't have a pre-quiz before each lecture, so the one for the week is for both lectures. We don't list the reading on the Tuesday, because if you're going back and saying, gosh, I didn't understand that lecture at all, and it's going to be on the test, we want the schedule to have the things you should study based on that lecture. Question is, why is Professor Khan in the earlier section lecturing us instead of Rice? In this section, you presumably ask the opposite question. The idea is that it should be less work for both of us, and therefore hopefully better for you, and that we're not rushing to prepare things as much. And you might get different perspectives. And we need to stay in sync anyway, so it's not like we can do dramatically different things in this course because we're sharing labs. So one question about bringing back the WebM recording. So Samira uses different software, that's why the recordings are different. I could make a WebM version, but I'm not sure that would actually solve any problems you're having viewing them or anything like that, because this often depends on things besides the format exactly. So if you're having problems with them, I'd like to know. I'd like to figure out some workflow we can have which doesn't involve transcoding the files and making them really low quality and still works for you. Another question about whether we could go over the quizzes. I generally don't think we have enough time to always go over quizzes, but if you have questions on quizzes, I'll be happy to take them during class. And or you can ask on Piazza. I'm happy to give a solution to a particular quiz question. We probably generally don't have the time to make it productive for us to like write out worked out solutions to each quiz problem, but we're happy to go over any of them that you want to go over. Speaking of quizzes, there was a complaint about that Khan fumbled their answer about flags, and you asked this question about flags. Yeah, that was very confusing. And indeed, a lot of people didn't get that question right. But I don't think fumbling exactly how flags are set is particularly relevant, because what you needed to know for the question was that CompQ is subtraction without storing the results. That's all you actually need to know, because the answer was none of they're the same because we ignore the results. That's what you need to know. You didn't need to actually know exactly how subtraction set flags. You just need to know that comp did the same thing subtraction did, except for where the result went, the flags were the same. So then a question saying, could you spend 5 to 10 minutes going over string sep? I don't think I can spend 5 to 10 minutes going over string sep, but it's confusing enough. It's worth talking about what is this string sep thing we're having you implement. So here's an example of how string sep, the function you're writing, might be used. So we have this string with and we want to separate it up into tokens, into pieces. In this case, our tokens are separated by a space. That's why we're passing a space as an argument. And we're going to have this convenient loop which needs an extra parentheses, where we print out each word separately. So we get each word and an iteration to the loop. And the way this works, it doesn't allocate memory to make a copy of the word. Instead, it replaces the spaces with a backslash zero. So the first time you call this, it replaces this first space, the one after this, with a backslash zero, and returns a pointer to the beginning. And since our strings are terminated by that null character, that backslash zero, that is this, the word this. And to keep track of where it is, it needs to modify this pointer you pass in, a pointer to a pointer, so it modifies the pointer that points to say where it is in the string. So after one call, it's going to insert a null here, and this pointer is going to point to the I in is. So the next time you call it, it's in the right place. So any questions, comments, more confusion? Yes?
The backslash zero just counts as one character, though you don't have to like.
Yeah, it's one character. It's literally the number zero stored in a char. And this is just the way you can write it in a string and see. Yes?
Should there be a backslash zero after test
or? So the question is, should there be a backslash zero here? I didn't write it just because it's implied when you have a string literal in C that there's a backslash zero after it. But there is one there, yes. Other comments, questions? So another piece of anonymous feedback. Someone thought that one of the bit manipulation questions on the post quiz was not right. So there's a question where the correct answer was it looks to see if a number is a power of 2. This expression checks if V is a power of 2. And someone thought it didn't, would return true for, say, 6. Now, if you tried this in C, I'm pretty sure that wouldn't happen. But I think the confusion, which is one we probably should clear up, was between which things are logical operators, which means that they treat their two operands as a true or false value, or bitwise, which means they work bit by bit. So this exclamation point operator, the thing you've used normally for doing logic in C, that's logical. So if you pass 4 to the exclamation point operator, it's going to give you 0. It's not going to give you 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, you know, taking each bit and negating it. It's going to treat the thing as either true or false and give you the opposite of that. If you use this tilde operator, that's complement, that is bitwise. So that will, if you give that 4, it will give you something where the bit 0, bit 1 are set, bit 2 is not set, bit 3, 4, 5, and all the way up to the end of the number are all set. You try to take the complement of 4. Similarly, you have, as we mentioned, double ampersand, that's the logical operator. It's the one which short circuits, and it also works on treating values as entirely true or false. It doesn't go bit by bit, but and is. So if you evaluate this expression, when we get this exclamation point 4 here, that doesn't turn into something which has some ones and some zeros, it turns into 0, because 4 is true, because it's not 0, and 0 is our only false value, so that true value turns into the false value, 0, that we return from logical operators, and when we AND that with 6, with the logical AND, we get 0. Any questions about this? Okay, so next I'd like to talk about the list homework that comes after our string len string step lab that you have to be there for this week. And I'd like to just briefly go over, there's three types of lists that we might use, and you'll be randomly assigned to convert from one type to another, and write an append and remove if equal method for the type you convert to. And the three types are a sentinel terminated array. So this is like a C string. A C string is terminated by a null character. We're going to use a different sentinel. In this case, this code uses -999. The code we give you will define the sentinel, and you should not change it, or else the test won't work. And we have a pointer to some allocated memory, which has the sentinel at the end. And that's how you know how long it is, which means that when you allocate space for it, you need space for that sentinel. The other option is what we showed as the alternative to a vector, where we have a pointer and a length in a struct. And the pointer is allocated dynamically, and the length tells you how big it is. You don't look at what the pointer to determine the size. And our third type is a linked list. I hope you're familiar with a linked list from prior classes. And one piece of confusion for people is exactly which parts of these are dynamically allocated with malloc and freed with free versus not. And there's basically this border. So the pointer to the sentinel determinant array, that's going to be on the stack or in registers. You aren't going to malloc the pointer. You're going to malloc what it points to. The range struct, the entire struct, is going to be on the stack or in registers. We aren't going to be mallocing it. This is probably the most confusing part of this. And for the linked list, each linked list node is going to be allocated dynamically, but the pointer to it will not be. So, any questions on any of these? Okay, so one final bit of logistics. So we have a final, which is combined with the other section, so we don't have to try to give two finals and hope that you don't share information with each other or make up two versions of the final. It's on the final schedule in a combined final slot for 9 May, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. This is also on the course webpage. At some point, we will announce a location when we actually book a room for it. And we will have a forum if you can't make it to figure out an alternate time, since maybe some of you can't do that. So any non-anonymous feedback, questions, comments, before we move on to the main topic of the day? Yes?
Just a question. So will we be having a quiz tomorrow in the lab?
The question is, will we be having a quiz tomorrow in the lab? Yes. Tomorrow's lab is the one where you have to write stringlen and stringcep in lab, and you can go to the lab write up and go to the interface to practice exactly what you'll see in lab and need to do on the lab machines while TAs are making sure you aren't pulling out a notebook with a solution and copying it or something like that. Yes? The list homework, it's due before the next lab. Generally, with a few exceptions that are on the schedule, like at the end of the semester, things might be different. But generally, homeworks will be due at noon on a lab day. Any other questions? Okay, so I showed you this giant list of ISAs that exist. You might ask, what's different about them? You know, is there really that much to do? And there's lots of ways of looking at the sort of choices people designing ISAs had to make. And I'm going to look at today some high-level choices that sort of reflect what's varies between ISAs. And one thing to look at is just sort of hard numbers about both how they're encoded and how much stuff they have, how big they are. So we have our instruction length. How much space does each instruction take in the machine code that the processor actually reads from memory? And you know, we have some ISAs here which have variable length instructions, some which have fixed length instructions, and ranges from things where, you know, maybe typical instructions are 1 byte or 2 bytes to ones where they're 4 bytes, and you know, the max varies a lot. We also have big variation in how many instructions there are. So our ISA for this semester has 18 which you should be happy about because you're going to have to implement all of them. You would not like to implement 1,500. I note that I say approximate here because counting numbers of instructions is a little tricky. For example, x86 lets you add 32-bit numbers and 64-bit numbers. Are those different instructions? Depends who you ask. So these are all approximate counts because I'm kind of fudging the issue of whether instructions are different when they take memory operands or different sizes, etc. There's also a big difference in how many registers you have. So we have some instruction sets which have very few registers, which means you can expect to be accessing memory a lot more, but it also means that they take less space to implement on a chip. And some with a very large number, like ARM, PowerPC, and Itanium with this 128 general purpose integer registers. So this is sort of one high level view, so that people had different trade-offs for how much stuff they wanted to give the programmer versus how complicated they wanted to make the hardware to implement. So there's some other choices, which I'm going to talk about largely because I don't think you've seen the alternative to what x86 does that is common among real instruction sets. So one thing is that in this class, we just talked about condition codes. There's this way where in x86, when you want to do a branch that's dependent on some test, you do an instruction to set condition codes and then have a jump instruction which uses them. So you have this two instruction sequence to do something conditional. But on other ISAs, they'll have a different way of doing conditional branches. They won't use condition codes. Instead, they'll have something like a branch if equal instruction. So this instruction would compare R11 and R12, and if they're equal, it will jump to somewhere. Otherwise, it will keep going normally. And there are various arguments about which one of these is easier to implement, easier to understand. And our book asserts, which I think is not true, that RISC ISAs, which are called RISC, typically do this. Some of them do. I don't think it's as true often enough that you can say it's really an attribute of being a RISC ISA. But you'll commonly see this. There's many ISAs out there which do this instead of using condition codes at all. So another big choice besides sort of what instructions you have is what operands they take. So in x86, we have this weird choice of letting us specify four things to specify a memory operand, and we also have the choice of specifying a register. Other ISAs make different choices here. So for example, in ARM, you can't do this three things addressing mode, but they do have this weird choice of letting you specify not just a register, but say, I want the value of this register shifted over by 3. That's the second thing I'm going to pass to my add. That's a thing you can do in ARM. They just decided that it was really convenient to do that, so that's in the instruction set. And there's other weird choices. So VAX, which is an instruction set from the 70s, maybe the 60s, has many addressing modes, and one of them lets you use a register as a pointer to a pointer. Say, use this register, read that value in memory, and use that address to access memory again. They just decided that, that was convenient enough to have in the instruction set. And if you remember my earlier chart, VAX also has very few registers, so it makes sense that they want to make accessing memory more convenient. But there's these different choices, so the world is not just this sort of addressing mode. Other architectures will support different sets of ways you can specify operands. Another big difference is how many operands you have. So you've seen this sort of two operands, where one is a source and destination, and the other is a source. Not all ISAs do this. In fact, a lot of ISAs use three operands. So what's a disadvantage to using three operands on an instruction? Why would you not want to do that? As a designer of an instruction set, why are you losing by choosing this three operand form? back there?
The instruction would take up more space.
Yeah, so the big thing we're losing is that if we have this three operand form, we need to fit three operands in our instruction encoding. So that's going to be, you know, basically a third more space to encode the operands. And that, in fact, you know, means that if we have a certain number of registers, you know, we'll need a certain amount of space to encode all the possibilities. So the advantage of this form is it makes the instruction simpler. The advantage of the three operand form is that, well, your instructions are more powerful, and it's not actually much more complicated what they're doing. So sometimes in x86, you need to like do a move instruction in order to not overwrite something you care about with an app. That's not likely to happen with a three operand form. And some ISAs, like VAX, the old example, I'll be showing up more, supports both. You know, they just have both versions of the instructions. Okay. So any questions on these instruction set choices? So we have this whole huge bunch of choices, and I've told you that these are sort of about managing the complexity of our hardware along with the convenience of our programmer. So it is what sort of guides these choices. Is that when they've designed an ISA this way, they wanted to have the instructions that were useful, they wanted to have a number of registers that were useful, but they also wanted to make it easy to implement efficiently in the hardware. And both of those are going to be concerns when you design an instruction set. That also comes in with what addressing modes you support. You want to support addressing modes that are easy to implement in the hardware. And as we'll learn later in the semester, it turns out, for example, this VAX one is not that easy. But this one is actually really easy, which is why ARM implements it. But also are convenient to programmers. So there's that sort of balance. And there's a general split that our textbook talks about, which is CISC versus RISC, which you can think of as sort of different philosophies for instruction set design. And I think the best way to understand this is to understand what RISC is a reaction to. There's not a hard line. We're not going to be able to say, this instruction set is CISC, this instruction set is RISC. This is going to be more like, this instruction set is more RISC-like, this one is more CISC-like. There's not going to be a way we can say what instruction sets are really this reduced instruction set design versus not. This is especially true with modern instruction sets. So there are two examples, that one of which we'll look at, one of which is definitely RISC. So MIPS1 is an example of an instruction set, and it's the one our textbook is referring to without naming, really. When they talk about RISC versus CISC, early RISC versus CISC. And that's definitely a RISC instruction set. And the VAX instruction set, which I'm going to talk a bit more about, is definitely a CISC instruction set. And I think the best way to understand RISC is to look at the sort of CISC instruction sets they were reacting to and what they did. And this is really about instruction complexity. So RISC wants to reduce the complexity of instructions. We want to make instructions simpler. And we have some examples of some complex instructions that you're familiar with. For example, push, pop, and on x86, write multiple values. This is much more complicated than your typical instruction. They write multiple values because they update either memory or register and the stack pointer. They write multiple values with one instruction. And there's other instructions in x86 with this. For example, movesb is an instruction which copies a value from memory to memory. That's also something that's pretty complicated. You're accessing memory twice, which, as we'll learn later, is more complicated on the typical way memory works for the CPU. But this sort of complexity, which is what the examples you kind of point to show that x86 is CISC-y, that our textbook would probably point to, are not the sorts of things that the designers of MIPS1, those people at Stanford and also people at Berkeley at the time, were reacting to when they proposed RISC, this reduced instruction set computer. Let me show you some examples. I'll give you some time to read these, of actual VAX instructions. You can read what these do. Think about how you might implement that. So we have match C, find a string in another string, given the lengths of the string. We have evaluate a polynomial of some size that you specify. And we have something, you know, kind of like printf as an instruction. This is things that VAX actually supported in one instruction. This is enormously more complicated than push. Push is considered complicated. This is way out there. You might wonder, how the heck did they implement this? This doesn't seem trivial to make in hardware. And the general strategy that was being used at the time was something called microcode. And this is still used today, but not to the extent it was used in the VAX era. So here, to find a string in another string, it feels like we need a loop in hardware. And the way this was implemented on typical VAX machines is that there was a lookup of a sequence of microinstructions that implemented match C. So basically, there was this second secret ISA, which had, instead of instructions, microinstructions, that was simpler than the normal ISA. And it looked up the microinstructions for every instruction you gave. And that's what actually implemented things. And the RISC people observed, oh, we already have this simpler instruction set. Why aren't we just using that? It's obviously a less convenient instruction set for assembly programmers, because match C is a really nice thing to have in assembly. It saves you a lot of time. But that was their reaction. And so the RISC thought was that these complex instructions were usually not faster. And the big reason why they weren't faster is that they turned into roughly the same microcode operations, the way they were implemented, as the simpler instructions. So they basically were about the same speed. So even though you were doing more work in one instruction, it wasn't the case that each instruction took one cycle. They translated into these simpler micro instructions, and it was probably about as bad. And they were harder to implement. So if you're designing a processor, you really want to make sure that you've implemented the instructions correctly. You don't want to find out that your add doesn't work sometimes. Because your reaction to that is basically going to be you're going to have to replace the processor. But when you have instructions like find a string in another string, you have a lot more to test, a lot more cases to test. And it's just harder to actually both write that microcode and verify that it works correctly. And another big change was something happening in the software world at the time. So at the time of the VAX, the reason why we had these instructions like this is that coding in assembly directly was common. High-level languages were quite old, but for the most part, people didn't really like them for coding, and the compilers weren't actually that good. Compilers would often generate pretty bad code. And at the time that academics came up with RISC, compilers were getting better. And it was plausible to think that maybe we can trust compilers more to generate reasonable code for us. And if you trust compilers more, it makes sense to have the compilers generate the sequences of the simple instructions for you rather than having the complex ones. Because it's going to make the hardware simpler to implement, and therefore, hopefully, your hardware will be faster. Because the hardware designers can focus on things besides implementing complex instructions that will improve your program performance or reliability. So here's my list. The textbook has a slightly different list of what I think typically means some instruction set is more like a RISC instruction set. So as I said, there's not a hard line. And many of these are pretty subjective. What does it mean for instructions to be simpler? It's not actually clear exactly what counts as a simpler instruction. So it's not like you can look at an instruction set and say, yeah, it meets all these. But generally, the big thing that RISC has is that they have simpler instructions. They don't want to do these loops instructions. They want all instructions that are simple to implement in hardware. And generally, that means they're going to have fewer of them because that makes the hardware simpler. Another property is that to keep the hardware simple, they're going to separate out the instructions that access memory from other instructions. So in the RISC design philosophy, we have one little set of the part of the hardware to implement these instructions that load and store for memory. And those are separate from all the stuff that does arithmetic. The arithmetic is just going to need to deal with registers, and that's going to keep that logic simpler. And in keeping the logic to deal with instructions simpler, RISC-ISA is typically used fixed-length instructions. So this means that it's easy for the processor to figure out where the next instruction is. In the ISA we'll be using, we won't have fixed-length instructions, so you're going to need to do some work to do that. It does have some disadvantages. It means, for example, on these instruction sets here, which have 4-byte instructions, if you want to fit a 4-byte value in an instruction, you can't do that. There's not enough space. We need to fit something about what type of instruction it is, and then we don't have room for 4 bytes. And so I've given some expansions on these simpler instructions. So there's certain kinds of instructions you will pretty much never see in instruction sets people call RISC. So one thing is you'll never see, like that in those VAX examples, instructions which must do a loop. That's pretty much never going to happen in anything people will ever call a RISC instruction set. You also pretty much never see any instructions which have 2 memory operands. Instructions will generally access memory conceptually once. They might internally implement it with multiple memory accesses, but it's going to look like one access to memory. And generally, they will have, consistent with this, few addressing modes. So in x86, we had all these options for how we specify something we want to add. We can specify a register, a memory location in like 6 different ways, and there's actually more addressing modes that you can use in add, which we didn't tell you about. On RISC ISAs, there will typically be very few addressing modes. Often there's exactly one way you can specify a memory address. So any questions on any of these properties? Okay. So let's keep these in mind as we look at the instruction set we'll be using to implement our processor, which is the Y8664 instruction set. So it's in your textbook. You presumably started reading about it. And it's based on x86, but it omits most of those 1,000-plus instructions. And these are the instructions you're left with. So here I have JCC, that means jump with a condition code, and CMOVECC, which means conditional move with a condition code. So CC stands for something like LE, G, G, etc. Those things you've seen, so all those variants of jump, and in this case CMOVE, which we'll talk about since I assume you haven't seen it before. We also have some instructions which are basically the same as an x86 instruction, but have been renamed. And the first one we'll go through is probably the most important of them, which is MoveQ. So, and Y8664 MoveQ isn't called MoveQ anymore. It's named to something else, in fact, multiple something else's. So our pattern is that we'll have a name which is some indicator of what the type of the source is, and some indicator of what the type of the destination is. And our options are going to be immediate, which we're going to represent with an I. Immediate means a value that's in the instruction itself, a constant value, to register, or a value in memory. And this gives us this possible 9 instructions we could have. And we're not going to have all of them. So for example, moving into an immediate, moving into a constant doesn't make much sense. So those instructions don't exist. And arbitrarily, we're going to not have the instructions which move from an immediate to memory. We could have that, we won't. Or from memory to memory. We're just not going to have those. So we're left with moving from an immediate to a register, from a register to a register, and from memory to a register, and from a register to memory. And these two instructions are the only moves that access memory. And so we've split out this move queue into these 4 instructions. And that's what you got. And yes, we did implement some of the options. So if you want to do a move from an immediate to memory, how can you do that on YD6? Yeah? Yeah, so if I want immediate to memory move, I don't have it, so I'm going to do IR move queue followed by RM move queue. And if I don't have a spare register, well, too bad. So that's move queue. This is probably the most important of the renamed instructions. Also going to talk a bit about conditional moves. So conditional moves are a thing that exists on x86, but I'm guessing you haven't seen it before. Who's seen CMove before? Okay, no. So these exist on x86, but you probably haven't used them. Our textbook has you implement them, and they're actually not that hard to implement, which, conveniently. So this is a conditional move. And on y86-64, these are register-to-register moves only. So there's basically a version of RR move queue that gets skipped if some condition is true. So instead of having jump over this move if the condition code say less than or equal, I can just use CMoveG, move if greater. This is shorthand for that, which just takes less instructions. And it's going to turn out that this is going to be pretty easy to implement if you know how to implement conditional jumps. Probably easier than implementing the jump. Any questions on how this conditional move works? Okay, so let's go over the other renamed instruction, and this is, I'm giving the x86 instruction, is HLT, H-L-T. So there's an x86-64 instruction called HLT, HLT. Which you probably haven't really seen before because it's an instruction for the operating system. So on YD664, we'll call the instruction halt with an A because we don't have a vowel shortage. And what the instruction does is it stops the machine. So when you make a simulated processor, we want a way to stop it because otherwise you're just going to keep fetching the next instruction. And we want to stop doing that, so this is the instruction to have a way to do that. And there's a similar instruction on real x86, but it's reserved for the OS. We don't want a normal program to halt the machine. So you could put this in your program, but it won't work because it's not part of the OS. Any questions on halt? Yeah?
What is halt ever called? Why
is
it exist?
It's to stop the processor.
Is that called when your computer shuts off? Or?
So the question is halt called when your computer shuts off? So the instruction on x86, I don't think, shuts down the machine. It doesn't like cut power. It just makes the processor not do anything until something happens. I'm not sure, but I believe that's what happens. And so I think the OS does it when it's idling. I'm not entirely sure about that. Actually shutting down the machine usually means you need to, it's not something the processor can physically do, just because it's like not connected to the power supply in the right way. It doesn't have like the power supply power going through it directly. But it functionally makes the processor stop doing things rather than keeping executing instructions, which is the same thing it's going to do when you implement a processor. I've shown you what the instructions are, and it's going to be different not just in what the instructions are, but also what operands they take. So what those addressing modes are. We're going to have less of them. So in particular, this is how you can specify an address. So this should be familiar from x86. This is a register to memory move, and here's our memory location. So it's 10 plus whatever address is in R12. That's the address to be accessed in memory. And this is a way you can specify a memory address. Everything else you've done on x86 that has more stuff, you can't do. It's not valid. This just isn't an instruction that exists. If you want to do this, you need to figure out another way to get that memory address other than writing it in your instruction. So this RRM move queue is going to be our only instruction besides stack manipulating instructions like push, pop, call, and ret that writes to memory. And MR move queue is going to be our only instruction besides the stack manipulating instructions like push and pop that read from memory. So this means that if you want to add a value in memory to a register, you can't do that with an add instruction. The only place you can specify a memory location as an operand to an instruction is the appropriate types of move instructions. All the other instructions that access memory don't exist in Y86-64, the ones that let you specify a memory location like that. So how could I do this on Y86-64 then? How would I have to do this? All right, if I want to do this, what should I write instead? Up there? You, yeah.
You would do the MR move thing, and then you would add from the register to the other register.
Yeah. So we're going to do an MR move queue, and we have this little bit of a problem that we need a register to put it in. So you better have a spare register, or sorry, where you need to like push something on the stack and pop it back off. But that's the general pattern, is that if you want to do this type of add, you need to copy the value from memory to a register with a separate instruction first. And similarly, you can't do any more complex addressing modes, also doesn't work. So how about this? How would you do this on Y86-64? So the question is there a multiplication instruction? No.
So you simply need to add a time stop R11.
Yeah, so one idea is that we could add R11 to R11 up 8 times. There's a little bit of a simpler solution, which is you add R11 to itself to double it 3 times. Yeah. You got a question? Or? I'm going to point out this is a solution.
Is there no shifting either?
Yeah, there is. Yes, there is no shift on here. Would be helpful if it was, but there is not. So this is probably the simplest way of doing that, and this track is R11. So it's possible to do everything, but it's a lot more awkward. You can also multiply and divide. You just can't do it with a multiply or divide instruction. You need to figure out how to do it with adds and subtracts and ands and conditional jumps. But it's possible. We're not going to have you do that. Okay. So constants. So IR move queue is the only instruction with a non-address constant. There are other instructions which have constants, but they're parts of an address. The only place where we have a constant which isn't part of an address is IR move queue. So this means, for example, that if you want to add 1 to R12, this instruction doesn't exist. So instead, you're going to need an extra register. You need to load 1 into that register, just like we loaded a value from memory into a register, and then add the two registers together. So this seems awfully inconvenient, but it's going to actually be more convenient for you because you're going to be spending more time implementing YAD6 than writing assembly for it. And as an implementer, you'll be happy that you don't have to handle all of these cases. Yes?
Are the constants in decimal or
hex? Because of how the assembly syntax works, this is a decimal constant. If I put OX on it, it would be in hexadecimal. And one thing you'll notice is that with all these rules I gave you, and an easy way to remember how this works, is that there's only one kind of value possible for each operand. IR move queues always have a constant first. Adds always have two registers, nothing else ever. So if you see the instruction mnemonic, the name of the instruction, that tells you exactly the kinds of operands. And there's no other possibilities. And this is why we split move queue into four different instructions, because each one of those accepts exactly one kind of operands. So now we follow this rule. Any questions on this? Okay. So in YAD664, we also are going to have condition codes. And we're only going to keep two of them. Our textbook uses three. We're going to drop one of them. So we're going to have ZF and SF. And like we mentioned last time, these are going to be set by all arithmetic and logic and nothing else. So add, subtract, and XOR, all going to set condition codes based on the result, so based on whether it's zero or the sign bit of it was set. And all other instructions aren't going to set it. And there's no other instruction which sets it. And the idea, one way you can think about the condition codes is that the sort of mnemonic that you see in the jump instruction, jump less than, jump equal, etc., you can think about comparing the result to zero. So jump equal means the result equaled zero, jump greater than equal means the result was greater than or equal to zero, and so on. And what the processor is actually checking is that the SF and ZF flag are set in a way which represents a value which compares to zero in that way. And we're deliberately missing the OF flag, so the overflow flag, which means we aren't going to handle overflow. Our textbook does. We're not going to have you do it just because we don't feel that it's a worthwhile use of your time versus other aspects of building a processor. And I mentioned that the subtract and XOR and AND, those arithmetic instructions set condition codes. We don't have other instructions that only set condition codes. So if you want to do a comp, you need to do a subtract, and you need to somehow deal with R12, in this case, being written with a value, either by not caring about that value or by saving the old value of R12 somewhere. Any questions about this, conditionals in general? So some notes and other, the most complicated instructions we have are going to be our stack manipulation instructions. So we're going to have push and pop. So they're like in x86, but a lot of people don't quite remember what order things happen in. So a way to remember, you know, whether push and pop move the stack pointer and then store or vice versa, the way I remember it at least, is that the value the stack pointer points to is always on the stack. So that means pop is going to give you the value on the stack, so it's going to give you what the stack pointer points to. And push is going to add a new value to the stack, so it can't write to the stack pointer, it needs to write below it, if we're drawing the stack in this way. We'll often have a reminder about what order things happen in on quizzes, but the way to remember it is that the stack pointer points to something that is actually on the stack. Similarly, we have call and ret, so you probably didn't deal as much in the past with what call and ret actually do, so as a reminder, call is like push. Except instead of pushing a value in a register, it pushes the program counter, the next instruction to run, onto the stack, and then it jumps to the address specified by the label. It sets the program counter to the address specified by the label, that is. So that's the next instruction run. And ret is like pop. Instead of putting the value it pops from the stack in a normal register, it puts it in the program counter, making it the next instruction run. So any questions about call and ret? These are by far the most confusing instructions when people have to implement them in the processor. So, and same policy applies. The address that ret pops is where the stack pointer points to right now. So last time we showed you sort of the idea of what the machine state was. We had registers and condition codes and memory. And that's going to be basically the state we deal with in Y86. But we have some changes and additions. So one change is that our textbook gets rid of R15. We just don't have it. Just doesn't exist. Our textbook gets rid of the carry flag. We're also getting rid of the overflow flag, but otherwise we have condition codes, we just have less of them. And that's part of the processor state, things that the programmer might notice. We have a program counter, even though it doesn't get explicitly mentioned in instructions. We have this extra thing called stat, which is the processor status. And this is going to come up because of the way we implemented our processor. This is how we're going to indicate whether the processor is halted or not. So generally, it won't be important, but this is where the information about whether the processor should be stopped working is going to be exported. So that's my brief tour of sort of Y86, 64 from the assembly perspective. So let's look at sort of how Y86-64 matches up against our RISC properties. So one thing you can think of our textbook authors as doing is that they took x86 and tried to make it more RISC-like. So they have fewer and simpler instructions to implement. They didn't keep any of the complex instructions in x86. So it has that sort of RISC property. They made it so we have separate instructions to access memory, which it turns out is going to make it easier to implement instructions in general. We'll see why later in the semester, but generally that's going to make it easier for the hardware at the expense of making our assembly a bit more complicated. Now, they didn't choose to go all the way to having fixed length instructions. And probably the reason for this is that we want to have like a constant in an instruction. And we don't want to say that that constant needs to be really small. And that's as a consequence of that, they don't have fixed length instructions. Also, having variable length instruction means that the encoding is going to be smaller than it probably would be if they used a fixed length encoding. So they kept the same number, actually a little less registers than x86-64, which is, so they have 15 normal registers. This is kind of in the middle of the instruction sets I showed you in that table, so it's kind of debatable whether that's RISC-like or not. Certainly 8 is on the low side, but this is not 32-bit x86 they're starting with. It's 64, which started with 16. And they certainly did not keep any instructions which have these sort of loops. None of this match C that we saw in VAX, where the instruction like looked at multiple memory locations, what had to be a loop. And we don't have any instructions which access memory to memory operands. They all take at most one memory location. And unlike x86, we have very few addressing modes. We have basically three ways of specifying operands, and only one of them is legal in any particular place. So three ways we can specify: a constant, a register plus a displacement, or a register. That's it. Unlike x86, where there's like, you know, a dozen more. Okay. Any questions about any of these properties? So given that, let's look at the encoding. So this is a slightly changed reproduction of a figure in our textbook, which shows us how the instructions are encoded. So they take up 1 byte to up to 10 bytes. And on this picture, the first part here is the first four upper most significant four bits of the first byte. So for a RET instruction, the most significant four bits of the first byte is hex 9. And the least significant four bits is 0. And you'll notice that these most significant four bits of the first byte of each instruction tells us exactly which line we're in, and therefore how big the instruction is. And we will call these first four bits the opcode. Our book calls it like the I-code. I'm going to call it the opcode because that's typically what an instruction set would call something like this. And some of these instructions, there's multiple variants on a line. So for example, all the arithmetic instructions have the same opcode. They have opcode 6, and there's this extra sort of secondary opcode here, which is labeled FN, which is tells you what kind of arithmetic operation. Similarly, for our jumps, including our unconditional jump, the opcode is 7, and there's the secondary opcode, which tells you if it's less than, greater than, or so on, or if it's just a normal jump. And the same is going to be true for register-to-register moves and conditional moves. They're going to all have opcode 2, and this secondary opcode here will tell us what kind of conditional move it is, or if it's just a normal RR move queue, a normal register-to-register move. So in our table, in our textbook, there's tables of what these secondary opcodes are. We're not going to have you memorize them. If we ever want you to do this, we'll give you the information. So for these things which take something representing condition code, this is the table. Yeah.
Yeah. So is the conditional move always between two registers?
Yes. That is the only form of conditional move that YD6 has. XD6 probably has more, but YD6, that's the only form it has. So for these condition codes, 0 represents the unconditional version. So our move Q is encoded with 2-0. And the other versions, we just have this table. And for opQ, we have a separate table. So we have add, subtract, and an XOR, and the other value possibilities we don't use. So this is how we encode what the instruction is. So it's all in the first byte, and even the you only need the first four bits to know how big the instruction is, and basically what we're doing. Next part is that we have some amount of space to encode the operands to the instruction. And the first thing you'll notice is that we need to encode some registers. So for the instructions which take registers, which is most of them, we have a number representing the registers. And up to two registers, so up to two numbers. Any of these are each going to be four bits, so we can store from 0 to 14, which are represented, correspond to our name registers according to this table, which again, we will never have you memorize. Though it probably would be nice to know that like R13 is 13. And you'll notice that we sometimes have a blank space here filled with F for the none register. For instructions like IR move Q and push Q, which only take one register. And some of these instructions also have constants that are part of the instruction. And in YAD6, all constants are going to be represented as 8-byte integers in little endian. So for IR move Q, for the immediate that's being moved into a register, and for the memory accessing moves, for the displacement to compute the address, those both appear after the registers, and they're always 8 bytes long, no matter what constant you put there, in little endian form. And we have two other instructions which take constants, and those are our jump and call instructions, or which need to take the address to go to. So in these cases, the constant is an 8-byte number, which is the address to jump to, what the program counter should be set to when the instruction executes. So any questions about anything on this chart? Yeah.
So in the reading, it said that each instruction has its own unique identifier. Is that the very first bytes of the zero byte, right?
Yeah.
So does that mean, like, fundamentally, there's a limit to the number of instructions you can have for each program?
So the question is, isn't there a limit to the number of types of instructions we could have?
Is not types, but like actual.
Oh, so that you said that. So the question is, the textbook says they have a unique identifier in the first byte. What they meant is that it identifies the kind of the instruction.
Oh, okay.
So just the kind. Yeah. So the limit, if we follow this rule, is just on the number of types of instructions we could add to YD6. Yes?
Well, so if there are only like this many instructions and it takes up a whole byte, could there be like way more?
So the question is, couldn't we have more compact encoding? And the answer is yes. Probably at the end of lecture, I will give some justification for probably why the encoding looks as non-compact as it does. But yes, we could save space here. Like, we have a whole bunch of instructions where we're not using 4 bits. And some, like, our push instructions take up 2 bytes and we're not using 8 bits of those. So we could be more compact, but we didn't. Are there questions? Okay, so let's go through some examples of encoding things using this instruction encoding. So here's a simple function. Here's an x86-64 implementation. So is this valid in YD6? So who thinks, yeah, this is valid YD6 code? Who thinks no? Who can give me a reason why it's not valid? So way back there. Yeah, so this add instruction doesn't exist. The only type of add we have is register to register. So what we're going to need to do, like we saw before, is we're going to need to load that constant with an IRMOVE Q into a register and then add it. So this is valid YD664 code. So let's look at converting that YD664 code to actual bytes. And basically what you're going to do to do that is you look at the name of the instruction, find the line of the table, look in your textbook or from a printout of the slide or something, and look it up and just copy what's there and fill in the blanks. So we have, for this IRMOVE Q, we have a blank for the destination register. So we know that's whatever the number is for RAX. We also have a blank for the constant, which we're going to write in little endian format as a sequence of bytes. So the first byte that we store in memory of that constant is going to be 1, not 0. And if we look up RAX in the table, it turns out its number is 0. And so this gives us the encoding. The first byte is 30 hex, the second byte is F0 hex, the third byte is 01 hex, then 00, and so on. And we follow the same procedure for the next instruction. So it's add Q, which when we in our table is listed as op Q, is one of the arithmetic operations. And we need have a blank to fill in for the function code, for that secondary op code, which we know is whatever add is in the table, and 2 blanks for the registers, which we just look at the table and see which register in the instruction corresponds to which slot. It's not always intuitive. And we look these up in the table, and we get our encoding. We get first byte is 60, second byte is 70. And then we look up RET, and RET is the easiest one of the three really easy entries in the table. There's nothing to fill in. It's just 90. That's a RET instruction. And then to figure out, write this out as sort of more like what we'd see in memory, we just copy out these bytes, and this is the bytes that we'll have in memory represented as hexadecimal. So this is what our processor is actually going to see. And I've marked, to make it more readable, the beginnings of instructions, though obviously in real memory, it's not like some bits are read and some aren't. So any questions on this process? Everyone think that you could do this if we gave you the tables and had it say on the exam? Good. So let me go through another example. And this is to show you how do we encode something with a label. So if you remember our picture, We had a space for the destination. I said that that was the address. So in order to encode this, we're going to need to know where this label is in memory in our program. And on a real computer, that would be done by the linker. It's going to turn out that we're going to give you something which is basically a combo assembler linker that will do this. So we're going to need to know that this is, say, address hex 123. And we'll need to know that for later. And we just do the same procedure. So first, we encode this add queue. So it's an op queue, so opcode 6. Then we need a function code for add. And the register is RAX. That turns out to be all zeros. And then we need to encode this jump greater than equal to. And that should not be an unconditional jump. OK. So that should not be 0. That should be whatever the value is in the table for GE. But otherwise, it's the same. So we have our encoding of this address in the instruction. I will correct this slide this afternoon to actually put the number of for GE, which we could look up right here. So that should be a 5. So it should be 7-5, then 2-7-5, then 2-3-0-1, and so on. And I'm emphasizing that this is little endian here because a lot of people get that wrong when they're trying to figure out what's going wrong with their processor or answer questions on the exam. So any questions about how this works? So labels are just going to be placeholders for addresses. And anytime you're using a label in an instruction, you just need to know what the address of that label is and put it in the machine code as a little endian number. So let's look a little about going the other direction. So here's a bunch of YAD664 machine code. And let's say you need to decode it. And I've given you the table. So what's the first thing you should do to figure out how to decode this? Look there?
Look at the starting bytes and try to figure out what the length of each instruction is.
Yeah, so probably what I would recommend doing first is look at these first bytes, which we determine tell us what kind of instruction is, therefore how long it is, and figure out where each instruction begins. So I can do that. So I see a 2. That means it's 2 bytes long. So the next thing starts at that 6. See a 6, that means it's 2 bytes long. Next thing starts with that 6, I see a 6, and so on. You can go through this entire snippet and figure out where each instruction starts. This is how I recommend approaching the problem. And then you can easily, you have it separated into each individual instruction, and you approach those one at a time. So you look at this 2010, and you say, OK, it's this second, there's third line of the table, and there's a 0 for whatever CC is. So you look that up in the table, and it's always, so it's an unconditional move. And you look up what RA is in the table and what RB is in the table. And you follow the same procedure going through each set of instructions. So when you get to this add instruction, it's 6, then 1. Add, then sub, 6 and 1. So 6-1 is subtract, 6-0 is add. And you're just matching things against the table, looking at which part of the instruction fills in which blank. So you should be able to do this, given that we've given you the table, which we won't have you memorize. So it's a mechanical process, and just, you know, I just recommend just be systematic about it, and it's definitely helpful to figure out where the instruction boundaries are first, because you don't want to lose your place. And you'll probably notice if you get the instruction boundaries wrong because you'll assign like opcodes which don't make sense at some point. before you spend time like figuring out what a little and how to rewrite a little endian value as an address or something like that. Yes.
So for instruction number 2 in the table, I don't know if it's R move U or C move
C. So the question is for this the second third entry in the table is R move Q slash C move CC. How do I know which it is? And the way you know is by looking at the CC byte, nibble, the CC 4 bits. If it's 0, it's the unconditional version, so jump or R move Q, depending on which line it is. Otherwise, it's a conditional one. So other questions? Comments? So, so I said I would give some justification for why YD6 is so inefficient at encoding instructions. We could be much more compact. And a lot of the decisions in the design of this encoding are really designed to make it more convenient to implement hardware. And you'll see this in lots of instruction sets, not just ones intended for use in teaching. That there's decisions they made which are designed to make hardware simpler. This is why RISC instruction sets use fixed length encodings, even though inevitably you're going to waste bits, possibly quite a lot of bits in a fixed length encoding. So one thing is that they wanted a nice, consistent way of getting instruction size and layout. So when you make your hardware, it's going to be easy to design the circuit that figures out how to get the parts of the instruction. With a more compact encoding, you probably need extra logic to do that. And part of that is that there's mostly uniform placement of where values are. So for example, the register I use to compute a memory address is always in this RB slot. So you never have to figure out where it is. If you know that whatever you have to compute an address should always take an RB as its register, this lower part of the second byte of the instruction. That's always where you'll find that. The condition code is always in the low order bit of the first byte. So if you have some logic which looks at the condition codes and tells you whether they're met or not, you can always look at those bits every time. You don't need to do something different based on the kind of the instruction. And our immediates are pretty much always in the same place. Not quite, but we don't use the immediates we use to compute the program counter and probably the same part of the hardware as the ones we use for moves. So that's not too much of a loss. So these decisions, which make us perhaps a bit less compact than we could be, are going to make our hardware simpler. And that was a priority, and it's often a priority in real instruction sets, is making the decoding simpler. And this means is also why there's no attempt to try to fit like multiple instructions in a byte. Like we could try to do that, but that would really complicate our hardware. We'd like need to keep track of a program counter in a place within a byte. It would save space, but it's not worth the hardware complexity. Another thing you'll notice is that if we jump to zeros, all zeros, that's the halt instruction. And that's not an accident. This means that if we jump to uninitialized memory, we're likely to actually halt instead of doing something else. It's more convenient. That's a deliberate reason to have halt be opcode 0. Yeah. So that's what I have on YD6. So next time, we're going to start talking about with Samira about how we actually implement this in circuits.